Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and last week we learned that the oldest fossils that belonged to Homo sapiens were 300,000 years old. We had thought the oldest fossils were 195,000 years old. Another finding, all this published in the magazine Nature, or the journal Nature, this finding announced by a paleoanthropologist at the Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Germany, there is no Garden of Eden in Africa. Or if there is a Garden of Eden, it's Africa. The Garden of Eden is the size of Africa. So what did we look like 300,000 years ago? How important is this discovery? How big were our brains? What kinds of tools did we use? And where exactly is the Garden of Eden? We'll have two guests with us this hour to talk about this remarkable finding. Shara Bailey is an associate professor of anthropology at New York University's Center for the Study of Human Origins. And she is director of the Dental Anthropology Laboratory at the Center, co-author of a study that was recently published in Nature about this Homo sapien fossil find. Chris Stringer will join us later in the program, merit researcher at the Natural History Museum in London in the Earth Sciences Department and the lead researcher in human origins at the museum. And we thank you very much, Professor Bailey, for being with us. Hello.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah, our pleasure. So how big is this finding?
Oh, it's very important. It's a pretty big deal, I'd say. You know, pushing back the origins for our species by 100,000 years is a really big deal, I think.
Mm-hmm. And the fossils were originally found, do I get this right, in the 1960s?
Yes, that's right. The late 1960s.
And so what happened is we have more sophisticated technology that can date this with much better accuracy?
The material that was found in the 60s included a juvenile mandible, some cranial material, I believe some postcranial material as well. And it was discovered through mining excavations, let's say. So it was discovered accidentally.
Mm.
So although they believe they knew where the material was found, not knowing the exact provenience is something that will always complicate the dating process. So in 2007, Tanya Smith, a colleague of mine when I was at the Max Planck Institute, and Jean-Jacques and a number of other people published a study on the juvenile mandible, the lower jaw. And they were able to take a piece of enamel that had broken off and date it using the techniques they had basing it on where they believed the fossils to have been found. And at that time, the date was somewhere around between 160 and 190,000 years old. The big deal is that in 2004, with continued excavation, so my colleague Jean-Jacques Houblin spent a lot of time and effort trying to go back to the site and continue excavations, and his efforts paid off because then they found a tooth and then they found some more material and eventually quite a number of additional fossils. Now, this new excavation, of course, was intentional, so they know exactly where they were found.
Right.
And so what you do with this kind of dating technology, which is based on trapped electrons, is you need to put in these things called dosimeters, which measure the background radiation and will tell you how, the accumulation rate of the electrons. And you need to do that from the place where the fossils were actually found. And that's why these dates will push back even farther.
I see. And are there a lot of excavations going on to find just such fossils?
Are there a lot of excavations going on? Well,
in Africa.
Yes and no. Every year, for example, my colleagues go out to sites like Hadar, where Lucy, the famous fossils Lucy, were found, and they have other sites, in the area, in the Awash area. So there's a number of teams that are out there excavating. There aren't that many teams that are excavating in this time period. And so as people begin to perhaps look in this time period, but usually in Africa they're looking in the much older time period, looking for early hominins.
I see.
Because that's been, very exciting and they've had a lot of success doing that. But as people begin to work and conduct excavations in this middle Pleistocene period, we'll probably find additional remains, too. I know one of my colleagues, Arai Lemziget, he has a site where they found the first Australopithecus baby, partially complete skeleton, but a lot of it's preserved. But they also have a middle Pleistocene site that they're excavating, so who knows?
Mm. Also joining us is Chris Stringer. He's a merit researcher at the Natural History Museum in London. He's in the Earth Sciences Department and the lead researcher in human origins at the museum. Chris, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, hi. I must warn you that there seems to be some noise on the line intermittently. I can hear you fine at the moment.
Okay, and we hear you fine at the moment, so we hope that it continues during the course of the conversation. So give us sort of a timeline here. We descended from chimpanzees and bonobos, right? So take us from that.
No.
We didn't descend from them.
No, we didn't.
No, we
descended from
them.
A common ancestor. I'm sorry,
Shall I respond to that?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So, yeah, we had a common ancestor with the present two kinds of chimpanzee, if you like, and estimates based on DNA put that around 7 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then evolution proceeded probably just in Africa for the next 5 million years or so, and eventually we come to the first things that we can call human, members of the genus Homo, our own genus.
Mm-hmm.
And we're now at about 2 million years, and then we have the appearance of a species called Homo erectus, and at least in conventional thinking, Homo erectus was the first human-like form to leave Africa and spread out. It stayed in Africa as well. So Homo erectus spread out, and eventually, over the next 1.5 million years, we get the evolution of different kinds of humans in different parts of the world. And about 500,000 years ago, there was probably a common ancestor between us and the Neanderthals and people who lived in Siberia that we call Denisovans. And then that evolution sort of went on. We continued to evolve in Africa. The Neanderthals and Denisovans evolved in Europe and Asia.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the simple story. And what we've lacked is really evidence of the early part of the evolution of our own line in Africa. So there were fossils in Ethiopia which look quite like modern humans that are 150,000 or 200,000 years old. And they look like us as far as we know in the skeleton. But we didn't have any convincing evidence, well-dated evidence before that of our line of evolution until this material from Jebel Ikhud was discovered and studied in detail and now well-dated to around 300,000 years, as you've heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. And what we found, let's describe, there was a fascinating picture in Nature and in the New York Times last week of what this skull looked like. It looks like it's this huge mouth, and the shape of the head is quite different than our human heads. Can you describe what we found in terms of what the hominids looked like 300,000 years ago? Professor?
So at least 5 individuals seem to be represented, adults and young individuals. And, yeah, in simple terms, I mean, they've got a face that's really like a bigger version of our face,
mm-hmm.
They're quite a modern-looking face. But the shape of the brain case is longer and lower than our brain case, so we tend to have a kind of globular brain case, a bit like the shape of a soccer ball, if you like, our brain case shape. So these, like other archaic humans, as we call them, have a longer and lower brain case shape. So they're primitive in their brain case shape, like us in the face, and they've got big teeth, but I think you've got Shara Bailey there, yeah?
Yes.
And yep. Shara's probably talked about the teeth already, or can do. The teeth obviously do show some primitive features, but also some modern-looking features.
Mm. So tell us about the teeth, Professor Bailey.
There are a number of aspects you can examine on the teeth. You can look at the morphology, which is basically the bumps and grooves on your teeth that you could feel with your tongue if you run your tongue along your tooth. You can also look at tooth size, and you can look at tooth shape. And as Professor Stringer mentioned, the teeth are quite large, and in that way they're somewhat primitive. But in almost every other aspect, they align with our species, even in some cases with recent members of our species. And in the cases where they don't align with our species, they don't align either with let's say Homo erectus, something that's much more primitive. So it's where they, when they don't fall right in the variation of other modern humans, they're between, let's say, Homo erectus and Homo sapiens. Mm-hmm. But they're not at all like Neanderthals. Neanderthals and Homo sapiens have extremely different teeth, and there's no doubt at all that they're not Neanderthal-like in any way except for in some, you know, in ways that they would share with other primitive hominins. Mm.
How did they keep their teeth? They sure didn't go to a dentist.
No, well, they didn't need to, right? Because they weren't eating high fructose and sucrose-laden diets. So, you know, it's funny that you ask, because the number of fossils that have cavities, I think Chris would agree with me, you could probably count on one hand.
Really?
Two hands, yeah, because they were eating high-protein diets, not refined carbohydrates, and although their teeth got worn down, they were in otherwise very good shape.
That's fascinating. Do you want to comment on that, Professor Stringer?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's right. Yes, it's very rare to find serious dental decay in people in fossils of this age. And, of course, that's good news for people like us and people like Shara, because, obviously, teeth really are almost like fossils themselves. They're highly mineralized, they preserve really well, and they've got a lot of information. And we have more teeth than anything else of our potential ancestors.
Mm. So somebody had suggested that the face was flat, and that had something to do with maybe the ability to speak, or that speech has to be associated with a face that's flat. Can either of you explain that?
Do you want to go first?
I'll start, yes, and maybe you can come in, Shara. Yes, I mean, it's obviously very difficult to talk about speech capabilities in people where you haven't got the soft tissue, but certainly the face is tucked in under the brain case on these Ehud fossils, on the ones that have got the face preserved with the brain case in a modern-like way, and that might suggest that, you know, the vocal tract was at least evolving more towards a modern shape.
Hmm.
But of course we haven't got that fossilized, so at the moment that's only really guesswork. We have to, I think, in terms of interpreting how much language they had, we have to look at what they were doing with their brains and what they were doing, you know, with any capability of speech. And obviously what we have got at Jebel Ehud are some beautifully made stone tools, so these people were technically very capable.
Hmm.
But just on the stone tool evidence, as far as I can see, there's nothing that necessarily says that they are much different from Neanderthals in terms of the kind of stone tools they were making.
Mm. What kind of stone tools were they making, Professor Bailey?
Yeah, so they were
making, as Chris said, tools that were similar to Neanderthal tools. They're called Mousterian tools. They're made using a prepared core technique, where you would take a choice piece of material, and you would flake off some bits of rock around the edges and make a particular shape, and then you'd knock it on its side and take off a point and then further modify that. At least that's how some of these tools were made. Chris might be able to add to that too.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, they're beautifully made, and actually, when you only see drawings of the tools, you don't get a view of how beautiful they are. When you see photographs of them and the color of them and everything, they're really very striking. And certainly within Africa, these are, for that date, 300,000 years, are certainly very sophisticated stone tools. And that's something that's interesting, too. We find an association of the Middle Stone Age. They've been classified into that industry, which we find right across Africa. So these are some of the oldest Middle Stone Age tools and, of course, the oldest members of our own lineage. So there seems to be an association already at 300,000 years of the Sapiens line in Africa with Middle Stone Age.
Mm. The New York Times article talked about, for millions of years, hominins remained very ape-like. They were short, they had small brains, and could fashion only crude tools. So the tools that we're talking about now are much more sophisticated than those crude tools?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they are. They require pre-thought. So a lot of the earlier stone tools, the ones made by early Homo, for example, are basically, you pick up a cobble, you knock off a flake, you use that flake, you throw it away. They're expedient, and they're not curated. Whereas the kinds of tools you see with Neanderthals and what we're seeing here at Jebel Ehud are ones that have a lot more thought put into them. You have to know what you want to make before you can make it. As I mentioned, you have to prepare the surface. You have to have an idea of what you're going to use it for. And then, you know, and then they may have retouched them also to resharpen them.
Mm. And tell me more about what they were used for.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah. So at the site, there is evidence of the use of fire and evidence of probably the animals that were being butchered at the site. So these people were probably stopping at the site, maybe bringing the stone tools with them. So I think the raw materials were from some distance away. So they may have had this area as a camp. Maybe, we don't know how long they stayed there, but they may have been passing through regularly for many years. And they would have been butchering carcasses, no doubt collecting plant resources and coming back to the site, lighting fires. I don't think there's evidence they were cooking the food, but certainly the fire seems to have been a regular thing at the site, controlled use of fire. So these people, of course, were living off the land, and it looks like they were stopping off at this site regularly, probably to sleep over and obviously to process their food.
Mm. Another major finding, the paleoanthropologist at the Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Germany said, another finding is there is no Garden of Eden in Africa, or if there is a Garden of Eden, it's Africa. The Garden of Eden is the size of Africa. How do we determine that from these findings?
Do you want me to go ahead?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I think that there's some good evidence of biological continuity between the animals that are found in North Africa and in East Africa, which suggests, you know, if the animals are similar, that means, and there's a connection, that means there would have been a connection for humans as well. And so what you might envision is, but what remains to be tested, is that in multiple areas in Africa, because there's also early Homo sapiens in South Africa too, although not as early as in East Africa and now North Africa, you can imagine that some aspects of our, quote, modernity might evolve in one place, other aspects might evolve in another place, and then through process of gene flow, right, people mixing with each other and moving between populations, that these, you know, eventually you come up with something that we all recognize as being very similar to ourselves. So, for example, the modern human chin, which is one of the things that we've typically used to identify Homo sapiens, is this unique protruding chin that has this kind of upside-down T-shape to it, and certain indentations, like, that may have evolved, and there's some indication of that teardrop shape in North Africa, you know, and then maybe that spread to East Africa, but maybe in East Africa the higher forehead evolved sooner, and then that spread to North and South. So, and I'm just kind of throwing some things out there, but if you follow what I mean.
Yeah, I follow what you mean. And somebody has said, what do you think about this, Chris, that if you saw one of these people in a metro, you may not even look twice, would you?
I think they would have been pretty striking and different looking. I mean, they still had a strong brow ridge over the eyes, and they had big faces. We haven't got much of the rest of the skeleton, but I'm sure they were very powerfully built. So, I mean, yeah, there was this saying, and probably could apply equally for the people from Ehud. There was a saying that, you know, you could put a Neanderthal on the New York subway and no one would bat an eyelid. And I think maybe that says more about the New York subway than it says about Neanderthals.
I'd have to agree with that, being in New York.
I think, you know, they would have been, I mean, we would have recognized their faces as being human-like, but I think they would have been very striking. We obviously don't know anything about the kind of hair and all that, what their hair would have been like, how hairy they were, those sorts of
right.
things still unknown to us. But I think we'd recognize them as human, but I think we'd have certainly noticed that they were pretty striking and distinct from anyone around today.
Yeah, interesting. So why Africa? Shara, why not, you know, Wisconsin? And then I also want to know, in the history, how long it took for people to move out of Africa. But why did it all start in Africa? Do we know?
You have to have the, of course, you have to have the predecessors to get the descendants, right? And so there are no apes in the New World. So you're not going to, if we share a common ancestor with chimpanzees and bonobos, we have an ape common ape ancestor. You've got to start where those common ancestors lived, and the common ancestor lived in Africa. And that, so that's where everything had to start.
Mm-hmm. And then we moved out of Africa when, Chris?
In terms of modern humans, it looks like there was a relatively early exit, maybe just over 100,000 years ago, and we find fossils in Israel, for example, that are just over 100,000 years old. It may look like early modern humans, but there had been a view that they didn't get any further than that. So in a sense, they were a failed expansion, but actually there's recent evidence that suggests that they might, in fact, have spread, even at that early time, out of Africa and across Asia. But it seems still likely from the present DNA data of living humans that most of our DNA, almost all of it, comes from a later expansion out of Africa that happened maybe 60,000 years ago. So that exit seems to be the one that is ancestral to most of the people outside of Africa. And of course, we know along the way there was a little bit of interbreeding with the Neanderthals and these people, the Denisovans. So we're not 100% recent African origin, which is what I might have told you 15 years ago. We obviously do have some intermixture, at a small level at least, with some of these other archaic humans, as we call them, outside of Africa, possibly even within Africa, because we haven't, I don't know whether you've mentioned it yet, but obviously within Africa, yes, the Homo sapiens line was evolving 300,000 years ago, but it's possible that there was a more primitive species, which is called Homo heidelbergensis or Homo rhodesiensis, that could have still been around in parts of Central Africa 300,000 years ago. And in the last couple of months, of course, we've learned that there was an even more primitive species down in South Africa called Homo naledi, which seems to have been surviving at about 300,000 years. So Africa didn't just have sapiens evolving at 300,000. There were these other more primitive humans still around.
Oh, interesting. And did they did their bloodlines mix or not? Did they stay separate from each other?
Well, we don't know the answer to that, really. There is some suggestion from modern data that there was some interbreeding with an archaic human in Africa, not Neanderthal, not Denisovan. Something else may have put some DNA into present sub-Saharan African people, possibly within the last 50,000 years. So that's a mystery that still needs to be explored. So there could have been some intermingling with these more primitive humans, but we are largely from the stock that relates to people like the Jebel Irgun people.
Fascinating. Well, we're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests. Last week we learned that the oldest fossils that belong to Homo sapiens were 300,000 years old, and we're hearing about what that means and what those people looked like and how it was determined, and it took us back 100,000 years earlier than we thought we had been around. It's really interesting. We also learned that it's Africa, the Garden of Eden is the size of Africa, so that was another big discovery here. And, you know, it's interesting. What do we look like then? What were our teeth like? Isn't that fascinating? They just had their teeth all the time because they didn't eat the kind of things that we eat. They didn't get cavities. There were all their teeth all these years ago. We're talking about their brains and about the sophisticated and beautiful tools that they made and what they were used for. We welcome your phone calls. We have two guests with us. Chris Stringer is a merit researcher at the National Natural History Museum in London in the Earth Sciences Department and the lead researcher in human origins at that museum. Shara Bailey is an associate professor of anthropology at New York University's Center for the Study of Human Origins. What a fascinating job that must be. She's the director of the Dental Anthropology Laboratory at the center and co-author of the study that was published in Nature last Wednesday. Here's how you join our conversation. We'd love to hear from you with all of your questions about this finding. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. And go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, if you missed the picture of the jaw, the incredible jaw of these early human beings. There is a picture of it on our Facebook page, and you can see all those remarkably intact teeth. All right, let's go to phone calls. Sam in Verona. Hi, Sam. Sam, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go right ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just went on my lunch break, and I was listening, so I love this. I was really interested in knowing about how their diets might have been different and why their, I mean, you mentioned that they didn't eat all the same stuff that we did, so their teeth were in better condition. I guess I just would like to like you guys to elaborate more on how that worked. And also, were there any other like things that you noticed about like their health or things that they did that we could possibly apply to the way we live now?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Shara, what do you say?
Well, the from what we can tell, they were eating large mammals, ungulates, gazelles, things like that. And so they were very likely hunting. They probably had a large game hunting kind of economy. But they were no doubt eating plants as well. And we what we haven't done yet, which could be possibly done in the future, is to look at the remains that are encased in the tartar of the teeth. So that stuff your dentist scrapes off actually contains DNA of the animals and plants that people eat, and also remains of pollen grains and things. So, for example, we know from some Neanderthal dental tartar calculus that they've scraped off that that they were cooking, and so it'll be interesting to see if we find the same thing with Jebel Yerhud. We haven't tried yet. But the thing is that people's teeth are very good in prehistory until they start farming, especially farming things like corn. And corn is a type of carbohydrate that's sticky, and it quickly turns to sugar in your mouth when you eat it. And the bacteria in your mouth just love that, and then they create an acidic environment which decays your tooth enamel. Before the advent of farming about 10 to 12,000 years ago, you really don't see that many cavities. And in farming people who don't, farm corn, the cavity rate goes up, but not nearly as much as corn farmers. But when you turn to then the Western diet with all our sugary drinks and juices, and then people's teeth just deteriorate.
Mm. Do you want to add to that at all, Chris?
No, I think what Shara said is absolutely right. I think from the bones preserved at Jebel Yerhud, I don't think there's any particular signs of disease on them. Is that correct, Shara, from what you know?
We haven't noted any.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, just as a side note here, does that all of this information change both of your diets in 2017? Are you informed by what you know about the past?
Oh, yeah. Well, but I've been studying teeth for a long time. So since I started studying teeth and seeing disgusting abscesses and cavities, my diet's changed, yeah.
Has it? How about yours, Chris?
Well, yes. Unfortunately, I had being a fair bit older than Shara, I'm afraid I had a lot more sugar in my childhood than I should have had. So, yeah, my teeth were not in good shape. So I haven't got anywhere near a full set of teeth, sadly. But I do try and look after them a bit better now. And diet-wise, yes, I'm trying to have a diet that's as varied as possible with as much fresh food. And I don't eat much red meat anymore. I try to eat a reasonably healthy diet, relatively low fat. What I don't get enough of, which our ancestors certainly had an awful lot of exercise in their lives. So I think I'm still lacking on that bit of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'm sure they did. Thank you very much for your call, Sam. Our number is 800-486-8655. Rod is next. Hi, Rod.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call, Kathleen. I was just kind of curious. When we were talking through the years, many years now, been talking about that at one time, that it was one continent, Pangaea. How do we really know that there wasn't, what we call early ancestors then? Because, I kind of referenced to both physics, to the science end of it, and the biblical. I find it interesting, and now since we got these phones, and you look at some of these blogs and stuff, some of these scientists, how some of them, find things out that kind of relate to the Bible. And of course, I know the evangelicals talk, well, the earth is 6,000, 8,000 years old or whatever. But of course, then it comes to the philosophical aspect of it. When they say years, in the Bible, it says God's the time. To God, time doesn't mean anything. So, what was they considered 1 year back then? Was it still the same?
Rod, what are you getting at here? Do you have a question for us?
Well, kind of the connection with with, like, if there was human ancestries when it was Pangaea as one.
All right, Pangaea. Anybody want to talk about Pangaea?
Long time ago. Wait.
You want to try, Shara?
Go ahead, Shara.
I was just going to say Pangaea is millions and millions and millions of years before humans evolved. That's when all the continents were, kind of in contact with one another before they split up into their present-day places.
Mm-hmm. From looking at, I'm wondering how long it take, and if we can, first of all, let me ask if these findings of these fossils, is there any way of knowing how smart these people were? And did the brain and the shape of the head have to change for us to become smarter, if indeed we have become smarter in some regards?
Yeah, that's a very difficult one to answer. So the brains of these Ihud people are only slightly smaller than the average brain size today. So they were large-brained. The brain was a different shape. I mentioned that our brain case and our brain today is kind of much more spherical in its shape, globular, we often call it.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a change in the shape of the brain with the evolution of really modern humans after the time of Jebel Ihud. And to be honest, we don't really know how that affects the quality of the brain, because the problem is, of course, you know, if you take an impression of the inside of these skulls, you get out a crude impression of what the shape of the brain was. But you don't know how dense the neurons were. You don't know how the internal wiring of that brain was. So you really get very little idea of the quality of the brain. And unfortunately, you know, we reduced, as I say, to looking at what they did with their brains. We look at the stone tools. We look at how complex their lives were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to turn to that kind of evidence. Unfortunately, once we get to 40,000 years ago, you know, we look at those beautiful painted caves in France and the little statuettes people were making and, you know, the incredibly complex tools. We know that those people must have been very like us in their capabilities. But unfortunately, at 300,000 years, you know, we've got so much less to go on. And one of the interesting things for the future is the DNA evidence, because, of course, you know, locked in our DNA, there is at least some evidence of the way our brains work. And we're only beginning to decode that for living people, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But once that becomes clearer, then we can look at the DNA of Neanderthals and Denisovans and of early Homo sapiens, unfortunately not anything as old as Ihud, but certainly early sapiens that are 40, 50,000 years old. And then we can compare them. And certainly there's the beginning of evidence showing that there were some differences in the way the brain worked between Neanderthals and us. And that's not surprising when you think that we probably split from them maybe 500,000 years ago. And that's then quite a fair time to potentially evolve differences in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Neanderthals weren't stupid. I'm not saying they were stupid, but we certainly could have had some differences in intelligence between us and them.
Mm.
But it's very difficult to pin it down at the moment.
Yeah, so we have to get a bit smarter before we can determine how smart they were.
I'm afraid so, yeah.
That's a good way to put it.
Let's go to Scott next in Westfield. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I was wondering if you can compare the ages of those early hominids to today. They may have had good teeth, but were they only living to be 30? Or compared to us at, you know, in the 70s and 80s, they're bound to have. I mean, I understand the diet had a lot to do with it too, but what about age? Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, Shara, would you like to
Well, we have a number of individuals represented, and some of the teeth are quite worn, so that would suggest that some of these individuals were old for a Paleolithic human. It's very difficult to age skeletons because we don't know exactly how fast they grew. We don't know. I mean, it's to age skeletons from their tooth wear, I should say, because we also don't know, exactly how fast their teeth worn down. But we do know that people with very worn teeth were, let's say, old. And that, to a Paleolithic person, old might be, you know, my age or Chris's age, right? So, but it's hard to know if they lived to be 70 or 80. But I certainly think, and I think they probably lived into their 50s and 60s, right?
Yeah, I think it's true that for these more ancient people, it is more difficult to find really old individuals in modern terms. I mean, they're there, but they are rarer. So I do think that the survival of people beyond 60, 70 probably was the exception back in those times. And I think something changed in the last 40,000 years maybe, that meant that we do get a much greater survival of those much older people, and they're being provisioned, they're being kept alive, and probably because there are social changes and their knowledge becomes, you know, an important part of the knowledge of the group. And also those people, of course, can do a bit of grandparenting and great-grandparenting and help their offspring, you know, with the survivorship of their children. So
right.
I think there is a change in the last 40,000 years with more evidence of really old people in the record.
Hmm. Can we see...
But
can,
I wouldn't...
I'm sorry, Cher, go ahead.
Just to address the caller's question, the reason for the lack of cavities is not because the people didn't live long enough to get them. So,
okay. And in terms of being able to see these fossils, will we? Where are they right now?
In North Africa.
Oh, will they be on display somewhere?
I don't know. Most people are not really friendly to the idea of taking their fossils out of the country. Occasionally, things like Lucy go on tour, and I don't know. That doesn't happen too often, does it, Chris?
No, I think that this material, I think some of it has been on show in Morocco, in the archaeology museum, I think in Rabat, so it may well be on show there. Hopefully people will be able to see it. Maybe eventually it might be allowed to be shown elsewhere. But what we do have, of course, are excellent replicas, and now we have the ability, of course, to do virtual images of this material. So we've already seen some of that in the coverage from Nature, beautiful rotatable skulls, images of these skulls, which you can look at in great detail. So, I mean, we do have virtual anthropology that allows us to look at this material almost as though it's there in front of us.
Yes.
Yep.
Go ahead, Cheryl.
No, I was just agreeing. That's a really big advance that we've been able to do with the virtual anthropology.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, we're going to take more phone calls, and here's how you reach this interesting conversation and fascinating finding. We're looking at these newly dated fossils from Morocco. This finding was published in Nature last week, and what we found here is that it's really altering the history of our own species. The oldest fossils of Homo sapiens found in Morocco, and it makes them us 300,000 years old rather than, I think, 195 was what last we knew. And it's quite a finding, and we're getting an idea of what the mouth looked like and the head looked like and how sophisticated they were, and just another kind of link in the chain. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. More phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have two guests with us who are heavily involved in all of this research and discovery. Shara Bailey, Associate Professor of Anthropology at NYU's Center for the Study of Human Origins. And she is the director of the Dental Anthropology Lab at the center and co-author of this study we've been talking about, published in Nature. Chris Stringer is joining us from London. He is merit researcher at the Natural History Museum in London in the Earth Sciences Department and the lead researcher in human origins at the museum. 800-486-8655 is our number. Sally in Madison is next. Hello, Sally.
Hello. Thank you so much for this. I was told in an anthropology class at the University of Wisconsin, I was sitting for the hour, and the professor had spent a year in, I think it was Iceland, and I said, I went down after the class and said, I think I have the shovel back incisors that was a marker that you described. He said, let me see. And I threw back my head and he said, yep, you've got shovel back incisors. And those are hallmark of that area you're describing. I'll say Eskimo area, but I don't really know where it is. But do you get in problems with religious people? Do you get in arguments when, you know, God created the earth in so many days? And I would think you'd be always in arguments.
Chris, are you?
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, you might want to ask Shara about shovel-shaped incisors. That's one for her, and then I can comment afterwards.
All right.
Yeah, okay. So shovel-shaped incisors are, it's a marker of ancestry in Northeast Asia or Native American ancestry, but that would also include your Inuit, which some people refer to as Eskimo. There's a whole complex of features that Christy Turner, has passed now, but he was at Arizona State University, is called Sinodonty, and shovel-shaped incisors is one of those characteristics that is typical of Northeast Asians and their descendants.
Hmm. Mm. And Chris?
And the question was about the age of the Earth and arguments we have about it.
Yes.
Indeed, of course, I regularly get emails and letters, particularly when I'm on programs like this, where people are questioning how we date things. And, of course, you know, the knowledge we've got now has been built up over a very long period of time, and the material at Jebel Ehud has been dated by two different methods, which are independent of each other, which agree pretty well. And, of course, we also have in the site animal fossils, and these animals evolve through time, so we can also look at their state of evolution, and that gives us also an independent check on the age of the site. So I think in terms of African sites of this age, this is actually a very well-dated site. When we talk about the age of the Earth, of course, you know, 300,000 years is nothing, of course, in terms of the big picture. You know, this is like yesterday, geologically speaking. I'm in an Earth Sciences department where most of the people are studying fossils that are hundreds of millions of years old.
Oh, my goodness.
You know,
right.
They think I'm just working there. You know, I'm working in the dirt that they scrape away to get to their important fossils. So they think I'm getting all this. Recently is, in terms of Earth history, you know, when you think the Earth is, you know, 4,500 million years old, something like that, 300,000 years is really like yesterday. So we are very latecomers in the story. There's no doubt about that. Hmm. There was a huge amount of Earth history long before there were any humans around.
But your Earth study is very fertile, right? So you can just tell them that. Yeah.
Yeah.
You got fertile soil. Mary in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Mary.
I'm wondering, how do you explain all the different ethnics and the people of color? If we all came from one Homo sapien, how did that happen?
Do you want me to go, Chris?
All right, go on then, sure. Yeah.
All right. People, when, as Chris said, probably the ancestor of all living humans today left Africa somewhere around 60,000 years ago or so, or perhaps there were some earlier migrations as well. But, our ancestors were probably of a medium to dark skin. And as people moved out into different latitudes, skin color responded to natural selection. And in more, the farther you get away from the equator with the reduction in the intensity of solar radiation, people evolve light skin, and the closer you are to the equator, then the more likely it is that you will retain darker skin, or even get very much darker skin than perhaps was ancestral. It's hard to know exactly the tone of the ancestral skin color, but we do know that there's a very good correlation between latitude and skin color in living humans today. And we also know that Neanderthals, who lived, of course, in Europe and some parts of West Asia, were, at least the ones that they have gotten DNA from, were light-skinned. And some of them, at least some of the Neanderthals, were light-skinned and had fair hair or reddish hair. So that's independent evidence for the fact that our skin color is easily affected by natural selection. It's in response to forming vitamin D, which is a very important vitamin for our skeletal strength.
Mm. Thank you, Mary. And let's go next to Dave in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Dave.
Good afternoon, Kathleen, and to your guest. How interesting. It's interesting for me to note that science in general and anthropology specifically is always open to changing your mind about things because we keep finding more things.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's heartening, particularly in an age where some people seem to believe that science is static and that history is static and so forth. The other thing, that at the age of 81, to know that There are beings around that are like 30,000 years old, makes me feel much younger.
You sound pretty good for an 81-year-old. You're sharp. It's true, though. Age is relative, right? That's what my mom always used to say.
One of the great things about science is that it's constantly changing. And so every time we find another fossil, it's another piece to this puzzle we're trying to put together. And so the shape of that puzzle might change depending on what new information we have.
Mm-hmm. So we're at 300,000 years. Will we, do you think, sometime soon, Chris, find out more, find some fossils that were 400,000 years old? And you want to surmise, take a little guess, educated guess, of course, as to what those might be?
Well, yes. In fact, I've speculated, in the last few weeks with the Ehud material and the Homo naledi material about what else must be out there in Africa to be found, because we've still only looked really in maybe 5% of the area of Africa has produced significant fossil human material.
Huh.
And we know from stone tool evidence that humans at times all over Africa, 95% of the continent still hasn't produced evidence. So I think we've got many more surprises to come, and some of those will be, as you've suggested, that we get an even older Homo sapiens, because I mentioned earlier on that the DNA evidence suggests we had a common ancestor with Neanderthals and Denisovans probably 500,000 years or even further back than that. So there should be even older members of that sapiens line, and there are interesting fossils, older ones in Morocco, and there's a fossil in Tanzania from a site called Ndutu, which could be 500,000 years old.
Oh.
And it's even possible, now, if we look at it closely, and that might even be an even earlier member of our Homo sapiens line. Now, we need firmer evidence, of course. We need more complete evidence. But, yes, the likelihood is that just as we found early Neanderthal fossils in Spain that are 400,000 years old, yes, somewhere in Africa, possibly even in Western Asia. I haven't mentioned Western Asia, but that also could be part of the story, because there are some fossils in Israel that are maybe around the same age as Jebel Ehud, which do show some similarities as well. So so saying that Eden was right across Africa, it's possible that even places like Western Asia could have been at times part of our story as well. Certainly 100,000 years ago, Homo sapiens were in Israel. And there are fossils in Israel at 300,000 and 400,000 that might also, could possibly relate to our ancestry as well. Hmm. So a lot to learn, certainly.
Mm-hmm. And once we refine, we have all this DNA testing that has become so popular now for us. Will we eventually, Ashara, be able to determine if we have Neanderthal in us? Will we be able to go back 300,000 years or not?
Yes, we have the possibility to get DNA out of material that is that old. In fact, they were able to get DNA out of this material that Chris mentioned, the Neanderthal ancestors or early Neanderthals from Spain, and they date to about 400,000 years. So the problem is that it's harder to extract DNA that hasn't highly degraded in warmer places than it is in colder places.
Oh.
And so although it's possible that it may happen, the likelihood is probably pretty low, because the DNA in areas around the equator, areas in Africa, is highly degraded by the time that we get it. But it's certainly a possibility. But yeah. We already know that we're 2-4% Neanderthal, at least modern humans around the world are.
All right. Thank you both so much. It was a fascinating hour. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Our thanks to Shara Bailey, Associate Professor of Anthropology, NYU's Center for the Study of Human Origins. She's co-author of this study that was published in Nature. It was released last Wednesday about the Morocco Homo sapiens fossils. Chris Stinger joining us by phone from London. He is a researcher at the National History Museum in London in the Earth Sciences Department and the lead researcher in human origins at the museum. And go to our Facebook page if you want to see the jaw of one of the fossils. It's there. It was on the front page of the New York Times last week, and we looked at it and said, oh, yeah, we got to do a show on this. Thanks very much to Colleen Leahy for producing this hour and for doing on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll be talking with two ex-offenders about the reasons for and solutions to mass incarceration, Hour 2.